So, just so you're alerted that I had too much champagne. Too little sleep, so that I'm glad this is the topic of forgiveness. And also, given where we are, it just follows that we're going to have another two meetings. We're going to go to the bitter end. So we will do religion. We may start religion today, but certainly religion in the beginning, absolutely next week, and then the final week, which already is like January. Just goes on and on. We'll talk about the finish absolute knowing and do some aspects of the preface, above all speculative propositions. So let me summarize where we ended up last week. After giving an account of conscience, the thesis, which I take to be, in a way, just reading on the train coming in from goddamn Long Island, Pippin's essay on recognition and reconciliation in the Della Giorgi book, he takes Hegel's core thesis, a version of what I've been arguing, namely, conscience is not in the head. And to say conscience is not in the head is to say intentions are not in the head, which is to say we don't know what actions we're committing when we're doing an action, that the deed we do is a worldly act, and it has consequences beyond what we intended anyway, and it can be interpreted by others, and on it goes. Therefore, if conscience is not in the head, and intentions are not in the head, this is Hegel's sociality. That the notion of mindedness in Hegel, of what it is to have, to be an individual who can use the word mind, doesn't happen by voices in the head, of which the notion of conscience is the most robust notion of voices in the head. The voices in the head can be the voices of what's right, but it also is, I intend this. That's another voice in the head. And I'm not suggesting you don't have voices in your head. You all do. Just that they don't count. What counts is social practices that are themselves normative. So that what makes an action mine is the way in which you are held responsible for it and the way in which you take responsibility for it. That is to say, mindness, and to be able to achieve a domain of what is mine or not mine, is a certain type of collective achievement. That is the achievement of a particular type of community. So that the notion of autonomy, of individuality, of intention, of action, all these notions are social and normative in character. Which is to say, and this is what we're going to be investigating, they both depend on others in very fundamental ways. They depend on having community of a certain kind. Some communities don't think any actions are truly yours. They think that the actions you might commit are ones that come from the ancestors speaking in your head. You know, I told you the story about the Vietnamese War. Maybe I haven't. Okay, it's from, I get a puzzled look. It occurs, I first read about it in Francis Fitzgerald, Frankie Fitzgerald's book, The Fire in the Lake, which is a great book about the Vietnamese War. And the Americans thought, well, we know that armies need leaders. And therefore, if you bomb the leaders, armies will fall into chaos. So the American strategy in Vietnam, like the French strategy in Vietnam, the Vietnamese, they're great. They defeated the French, the Americans, the Cambodians, and China never managed to get in there. That's a successful one. It's no wonder that they say, come, Americans, where are your friends? They don't care. They won the war. Vietnam won. So they bombed the leaders. And lo and behold, it made no difference. Well, why did it make no difference? Because the Vietnamese have a complicated structure of ancestor worship. And they see themselves as fulfilling tasks the way in which some large organism does it. That is, they have an idea of belonging to truly a community of the living and the dead. And they are just carrying something on. So when they're told, go in the jungle and kill 100 Americans, they don't need a leader to say, we'll tell you when to do it. They go out and do it not by individual initiative, but because they feel they're acting for that social organism. They don't have the notion of mind, or they did not have the strong notion of mindness of an action that we presuppose. Mindness, my action, my body, my deeds, is a particular kind of society with presumptions about responsibility, about ownership, about certain sets of rights, all this sort of stuff. Mindness is not an ontological feature of the world. It's not a metaphysical fact of reality. Mindness is a form of social achievement which has a variety of forms stretching over a variety of communities. We have, and Hegel is supporting from the time of Antigone, Hegel takes it for granted that modernity is a strong notion of mindness. That's what the notion of conscience tries to get at. The notion of conscience gets at the idea that we view ourselves as the kind of selves for whom individual right to determine what's ultimately right or wrong is a fundamental principle of our life together. That's a version of mindness, not a metaphysical hypothesis. It is exactly what modernity achieves. So conscience is the expression of a certain type of community. And this is what the conscientious self has to learn, right? That it requires the community of others to recognize its acts as conscientious, which I said is a type of language game of a particular kind. That is, it is a certain expressive relationship to your own intentional actions. That's the thesis of the duality of actions. That actions have two dimensions, intention and expression. The act intended is the deed done. What is expressed in the deed done is your relationship to it. And to claim that a particular act is done as a matter of conscience expresses a strong binding of oneself to the character of that act. That's the thesis, as in conscientious objection, expresses a strong binding of oneself to the act. And we can have a community that recognizes the value of that, that you are, as a matter of conscience, not fighting the war, you know, opposed to or in favor of abortion, willing to go to jail because you won't pay taxes to support the Civil War, Thoreau, All these are the routine notions of conscience, right? But what makes them conscientious, right, is having the social character of being conscientious, right? It's not anything that's there in the act. It's having a certain way of regarding people and the way in which they regard their own actions and how they're related to them. Once that becomes patent, then we recognize that the notion of conscience is, as Hegel would put it, depends on Sittlichkeit. It is our social ethic. That's the kind of ethical community we belong to. And that only in a certain type of Sittlichkeit, only in a certain type of ethical set of practices, is conscience possible. Namely, one that is informed by, right? And these are just, this is almost like the argument between Agnello and Andrew Arado, but one that is informed by Luther, informed by capitalist economic relationships, a form by the notion of the French Revolution and natural right of the individual, informed by some notion of universal equality. Conscience requires us to all agree to, as it were, you know, the sets of assumptions located in those series of historical episodes. And without that, the thought will not work. Now, it's on the basis of that that Hegel then moves, I suggested, to the setting up of a particular kind of community, and the original community he sets up is those who recognize themselves and each recognizing one another as bound to this idea of individuals as conscientious selves. And, as I say, I call this the hippie community, the community of love and dope, who, you know, were just happy in celebrating that they were this kind of community. And we discovered that what was wrong with that idea, the first model of a conscientious community, a community for Hegel, I should say, of beautiful souls. So all the figurations we're going to be looking at from here on in are forms of beautiful souls. All of them prizing a certain type of purity and trying to sustain that notion of purity. And they have each of them, therefore, is bound to, as everything else is in Hegel, but these forms are so close to our own time that it's kind of palpable. They're each bound to various kinds of fantasies about how the life of a conscientious self might be sustained, right? And this fantasy is, you know, the fantasy of, and there's a community like this, you know, in kind of Tennessee. Or in fact, I even saw a thing in the New York Times. There's now a community for senior citizens in Tennessee. Did you see this article? Of senior citizens in Tennessee who are after a hippie lifestyle. So it really is a community of old hippies. And they're all saying, yeah, it's great to be here. Prove yourself. And it is. But what makes it a fantasy, of course, is it's a fantasy of no change. It's a fantasy of ideal equilibrium. It's not an accident that the communes are always out in the woods somewhere, that they try to be self-sufficient, that you know, they want to do everything by consensus or holding hands or whatever, and which is to say they actually are forms of denial of individuality, above all, denial of the very possibility of difficulty or collision or significant action at all. So that they close themselves off to, the idea of transformation. And it's out of that that emerges, I argued, the final two forms of morality, which are, again, both forms of beautiful souls, acting consciousness and judging consciousness. Both of these are ideas of moral purity. The moral purity of the acting consciousness is that, and my suggestion again is these are think of them this way, these are your ultimate kind of forms of a master and slave. So this would be Creon and then judging. And this would be Antigone and acting consciousness. So these are what become of Creon and Antigone in a world that can make sense of the idea of conscience, which was blatantly missing previously. So now we have a modern Antigone, and the modern Antigone is someone, and I'm just therefore from now on going to, when I talk about acting consciousness, I'm going to call it she, and judging consciousness is going to be he. So they're a couple. They've always been a couple. And there's sexual politics, and you can figure that out for yourself. So now, our Antigone, rather than protesting against the laws of the state, will simply want to separate herself, that her interest, her purity, is interested in the minus of her action. That she wants to know that her actions are hers and hers alone, that they do not merely express an existing consensus, that they do not express the existing universals. So just to give the Hegelian logic up here, it's always a problem at this point whether we're talking about the particular or the singular, and eventually we're certainly going to be talking about the singular. So just to alert you that whether the acting consciousness is particular or singular is systematically indeterminate until, as it were, the last moment, because the last moment is the recognition of singularity in the meaning of it. That's how I see it, the logical state. But roughly, Antigone doesn't want to be merely particular. She doesn't want to think of her actions as merely filling a role. So you may think both of these, so particularity is the problem. And the reason particularity is the problem, remember the difference. Particularity is an individual acting in accordance with a social norm. And the question is then, is the individual acting or is the social norm acting? So particularity is the role as specified by the universal. And the question is, what's the individual's relationship to that? And acting consciousness, her greatest fear, as I expressed it last week, is she would wake up and discover that none of her actions were her own. That all along she's been doing simply what they say, what one expects, what the norms are, what, you know, what keeping up with the Joneses is. And therefore, she adopts a certain contrarian form of life. That is a form of life that is based on a model of transgression, of rebellion, of outsideness, so that, as it were, a condition for her being able to feel authentic is then saying, you can't do that. That's right. That's why I've done it. You know, and therefore she always has to, as it were, be othered by the society in order. I mean, the last thing she wants is acceptance, right? Acceptance is death. She wants exactly to hold out that distance between herself, right, and the rest of society. And this is a dynamic and difficult situation to sustain. We think of it as what bohemianism or avant-gardism means, which is exactly what romanticism meant, for example, the Schlegels and the community around them, to be constantly, Nietzsche had the phrase, self-overcoming. It's the idea of perpetual self-overcoming, of always re-legislating, always, even for yourself. For those of you who saw Professor Heller's talk, remember he said we are moderns, and what moderns means is we are open to perpetual criticism. Well, this is a way of thinking about how that notion of criticism really goes into the modern soul, right? That we want a notion of perpetual self-overcoming, of self-change, self-transformation. And therefore, I often think of this as a form of, to use Cavell, Emersonian perfectionism. And if you don't know the Cavell, the text to read here is Conditions Handsome and Unhandsome, where he lays out this idea he inherits from Emerson, that what the self wants is to consider each position it is in as merely a stage, on a continual path. And a continual path to what? There is no what. So it's a perfectionism without a telos. So the phrase, which is there in Emerson and Nietzsche, just had breakfast with David Dilworth, he says, everything in Nietzsche is in Emerson. Everything. Certainly this is. the idea of teleology without a telos. Thought of Emerson, Nietzsche, Heidegger, whole lots of modern thinkers think of this as continual self-overcoming. And that this first gets, I think, expressed in the Athenaeum fragments of the Schlegels in certain ways. I think that is the first authentic expression of that ideal. Well, judging consciousness, who sees, responds to this perpetual overcoming in just the way one might suppose anyone faced with perpetual transgression would do, namely, paragraph 660, judging consciousness argues that acting consciousness is evil and a hypocrite. Hegel says, for the consciousness which holds firmly to duty, the first consciousness counts as evil because of the disparity between its inner being and the universal. And since at the same time this first consciousness declares its action to be in conformity with itself, to be duty and conscientiousness, it is held by the universal consciousness to be
hypocrisy.
That is, on the one hand, judging consciousness is accusing acting consciousness of sheer, straightforward transgression. It is law-breaking. It is disagreeing with the laws, and what disagrees with the laws must be evil. The notion of evil is going to get much deeper than that. But this is the simple charge of being evil, namely as simply being law-breaking. But what drives this consciousness even crazier, judging consciousness, is that this outsider, who's dependent on her outsideness, also wants to say that what it's done, that's the law. That is, it means to be instituting a new notion. I mean, if an act's authentic, then you think you're doing the right thing, the dutiful thing, the universal thing. So it's both law-breaking and law-making simultaneously, right? Because we've already learned that all human action is legislative. To do an action is to say, this is the thing to do. You can't act without saying that, right? That's the legislative moment. And that she both wants to be law-breaking and law-making, the only way judging consciousness can respond to that is to claim both that she's evil and hypocritical. She can't want it both ways. Well, how could we put together a form of society in which we recognize one another as conscientious selves? So let's think for a moment now about judging consciousness. Judging consciousness wants to bite the bullet on the discovery of the hippie community that, put it another way, hippies and what I'm going to call liberals are not that far apart. What judging consciousness believes is that if we're to be conscientious selves, then we can only do so in a certain type of community in which there are standing structures of mutual recognition in which we acknowledge both the laws that regulate our social interactions and give space to the possibility of individual action. That is, it's to imagine, right, a certain stable normatively regulated form of life in which the relationships between individual and community are both given, let's put it this way, equal weight. And they're given equal weight by the kind of body of laws and principles and norms that we choose to regulate ourselves. So we imagine that if we're going to be this type of community, then we must have access to something like the necessary conditions for the possibility of there being space for conscientious objection. And it turns out that that's a society, and my suggestion was, it's a certain type of liberal society, not unlike the kind that you find in either Rawls or Habermas. That is, where there are simple principles of mutual recognition that are the conditions for strong notions of individuality and autonomous action. So what we imagine now is that judging consciousness feels that modernity must involve commitment to these bodies of, let's just call them roughly, a priori principles, right? And the a priori principles can either be something like Habermas's idea that nothing will count as a valid norm unless each and every individual who would be affected by the norm would have an equal opportunity to voice their criticisms and ideas about that new norm, and that their vote count in its rejection or acceptance. Did I say it okay? I have so much champagne left here. Okay, I'm just checking with the two critical theorists. Or in Rawls, it's the Minimax principle, which says something like, we cannot accept any policies unless the position of the least well-off in the society are also improved. That is, the necessary improvement of whatever policies we have to not only help everyone, but have to help the least well off and can't be disadvantageous to them. And furthermore, in the setup, there has to be a priority of liberty to equality. So, all of which, you might say, looks harmless, but judging consciousness things, this is the way we actually judge, you know, any other. Notice these are very general, high level, even weaker than constitutional principles. These are very high level norms by which we judge all other contenders. Commitment for the Hegelian view that these are broadly thought to be, and this is what's driven both Habermas and Rawls when he was alive crazy, is how a priori or not are these principles? They wanted to say that, and both of them have wanted to say somehow that we cannot do without these, that they are near as damn a priori. That's what the theory of justice tries to argue, and that's what Habermas tries to argue. It's that, I'm suggesting, that makes them beautiful souls. That's their purity. That there are these unchanging principles that are to regulate permanently our life together, and on the basis of which we will judge the validity or invalidity of any further principles that might be suggested. And there were, again, for those of you who had the Heller Day celebrations, some of the questions she was actually being asked and did not answer. People were saying, well, if you believe in freedom, Heller, don't you need principles to protect that freedom? Don't you need some norms? So there was a kind of ache for a bit of Habermasian stability, of which Heller was, of course, having none of, right? She's much more a modern, right, Antigone. Which is to say she's a half again. Well, that's what I'm going to argue. I'm glad she's not here to tear me to pieces. Well, this is an argument we've had more than once. That's the ground. So it's that now we have the reason why judging consciousness can call acting consciousness evil and hypocritical. Right? Evil because it breaks the a priori principles, hypocritical because it wants universals, but not the ones that must, according to judging consciousness, be the ones that we all accept if we're to have a community of conscientious selves at all. Well, what happens? Acting consciousness, I suggested, wants to avoid besmirchment of compromise, of having to negotiate her authenticity in relationship to others. This is why she stands on the outside, and she's always on the outside for her, and hence why, because she's always outside the standing universal, she is evil. Right? She's always outside the existing universal. So she is the incarnation of evil in a certain way. So what evil finally means for Hegel, and I'm going to say a lot more about this in about 5 minutes, but what evil finally means for Hegel is the irredeemable negativity of human action. It is that feature of human actions that makes human actions always more than whatever norms or principles or universals that we have agreed on or come to or have standing in our community. Evil is an expression of, let's call it, the outsidedness of human action. And I'm going to try to deepen that, as I said in a moment. However, the thought behind this is that we are each irredeemably singular selves with our own subjective wills. That evil is simply another word for subjectivity. Or a certain moment of subjectivity. Civil disobedience, therefore, is the paradigm of action of the authentic self, because it expresses that standing of the self in defiance of any laws that the community may have adopted, and it does so not as law breaking, but for the sake of law. Civil disobedience is for the sake of justice, for the sake of norms. When Thoreau refuses to pay his taxes, right? He's doing it because he will not support, right, a regime that supports slavery. This is an opposition to what he thought to be an unjust, right, situation. So the civil disobedient opposes justice in the name of justice. Or we might say opposes justice in the name of new justice. But to say that is always to say that there is more to the possibility of what justice is than justice has ever been. Go back to the Antigone section. It says there is more to justice than the written law. That there is an unwritten law, an invisible claim, which, as it were, only becomes visible the more justice that we require for our actions, by an action that exceeds all given law. So when Hegel chose those terms, written and unwritten law, right, he wasn't just thinking, oh, a bit of Greek religion and a bit of Greek democracy, right? He was trying to think of the difference between establishment and conscience, that there's more to justice than what has been discursively registered in our accounts of it. How
How does acting consciousness see the person rebuking her? How does she, Antigone, the new Antigone, comprehend the new Creon? How did the children of 68 view those they were rebelling against? I might get a glimmer about why I like this text so much. She sees the judge rebuking her as himself evil and hypocritical. And because evil is hypocritical, then necessarily self-deceived. Why? Because universality does not emerge out of a Platonic heaven. Universals emerge from the wills of particular individuals, and they get their force and authority by individuals binding themselves to them and committing themselves to them and acting on them. That is, universals are not things in the sky. I mean, so the moment of the judging consciousness is the last hopeless moment. It's going to get more hopeless in a second, but it's the beginning of the last hopeless moment of Platonism. Right? And it's important that we see this desire, this fantasy, that, you know, and we call it sometimes liberal neutrality or liberal indifference, or there's a whole lot of ways of trying to defend this idea that the liberal laws are, right, the idea of why neutrality, it's the idea that liberalism is supposed to be, neutral between competing ideas of the good life. So that it doesn't make a claim about the good life, hence it's the priority of the right over the good. So we're just going to set up an arena where each individual can pursue their own idea of the good life. But there is a notion of right, and that notion of right, so we've given up the idea of the good, but we still know it's right forever. So that notion of the priority of the right over the good is the kind of beginning of the last ditch breath of this commitment to a Platonism or Universalism that believes it can emerge independently of history and of human willing and of human passions. So when acting consciousness looks at judging consciousness, she does not see the authority of some Platonic universal being thrown at her, she sees a sovereign son of a bitch. She sees an individual asserting his will against her will. That is, she recognizes his, right, bearing in relationship to the law that he is repudiating. So she sees that he is just like her. That he, too, is an individual asserting his conception of the universal that he thinks ought to be legislated and pretending, his hypocrisy now, that it comes from the Hyperion, you know, from the beyond, from behind the veil of ignorance. It's all been cooked up and it just appears on the stage after the veil of ignorance is finally lifted. She, in short, recognizes that there is a simultaneous contest of universals which inevitably is simultaneously a contest of wills and cannot be anything other than that the two go together, that's how we have contests of wills, by having contests of universals. In recognizing that, that universals inevitably come from individuals, that there is no neutrality, no pure reason, she recognizes that they are in the same boat, and therefore, this is the gorgeous moment, typically the gorgeous moment that you just don't see coming. She does not respond with a philosophical idea. She's exhausted all her philosophical ideas. Instead of a philosophical idea, she confesses. She says, come on, guy. We're just both battling over what we each think is right. No one is above this battle. We have to find some way of doing it, but we are in the same boat. We are both asserting our wills. We are both putting forward what we think to be the right thing to do, and that is the only way in which a universal can arise, and therefore the only thing we could be doing. Paragraph 662, Hegel says, in short, she confesses to being evil. That's what she confesses. Of course, instead of saying, no, I'm innocent, I'm pure, I'm good. You're right. I'm evil. Why? Because I'm a person. I'm an individual. And there's nothing more I can do to get in a new universal than to assert my will, than to assert my subjectivity, than to express what I feel most passionate about. And I cannot, as it were, clean up the universal for you so that it does not bear the stain of subjectivity. Every universal bears the stain of subjectivity. That's the only way it can happen. So Hegel says, it admits, in fact, to being evil by asserting that it acts in opposition to the acknowledged universal according to its own inner law and conscience. For if this law and conscience were not the law of its single individuality and caprice, is it caprice in the German? Funny word. I'm not happy with that. It would not be something inner or peculiar to it, but what is already universally acknowledged. So, her thought is that by confessing to be evil, she overcomes any conceivable claim to hypocrisy. All significant action has an irrevocable moment of negativity that breaks the given consensus. Is it a piece?
I can't find it.
Can't find it. In confessing evil, the confession, I should say, is based on a recognition. The recognition that her and the other are the same, although absolutely opposed. They are the same in their opposition, namely staking themselves on their singularity and subjectivity. That's what she recognizes. Not that they share an idea, they don't. He says, bomb the bastards to hell. She says, stop the war. But they're both asserting their idea of what's right. In doing this, or here's the thesis I want to suggest to you, Hegel is claiming that all significant human action, all significant human action involves implicitly a confession of evil. That is, I am suggesting that all significant human action has an expressive moment to it. And part of the expression to it is a confession of evil. So my claim is that the notion of the confession of evil is not a singular moment in the unfolding of this logic, but an ultimate category for the understanding of the meaning of human action under conditions of modernity, such that you cannot act and do any significant human action without and mean it unless you simultaneously confess your evil. Let me say a word or two, I'll have a break, and then I'll try to defend that crazy hypothesis. In breaking this community, if I understand what that means, I am acting for myself and for the community. That is, the reason I'm law-breaking, as I suggested a couple minutes ago, is for the sake of a better justice, another universal, another idea of what art means, or what ethics means, or what cooking means. It doesn't matter, really, right? It's the idea of the of breaking of any horizon of settled norms and practices. In asserting myself, therefore, I am both expressing what I believe and what I believe is right and valid. There is no avoiding evil because there's no avoiding either the moment of transgression or the moment of subjectivity. So it's those two moments, the moment, the role of individuality in universality and the role of transgression in the creation of universals, that I'm going to suggest, as it were, constitute the meaning of significant human action, and therefore make the notion of evil not the outside of action, but I'm going to suggest the lining of any possible significant action. So the thought is going to be that to confess this is to secure a moment of community in exactly the moment in which I am fracturing community. My confession is the revelation of my simultaneous breaking from and acting for the sake of and therefore being in the very community that I am abiding to by breaking from it. Therefore, I can only be myself by not being myself, by emptying myself out in this particular way. My breaking with the community must belong to the community. That's just what Heller said is modern, right? She said in her talk, she said what distinguishes modern societies from traditional societies is in traditional societies, what we call modernity is called a crisis. And in traditional societies, when a crisis emerges, it emerges because there is a discovery that what we thought to be true doesn't hold, and there's another truth elsewhere. In the context of traditional community, the awareness of truth elsewhere is disaster and destruction.
is how that kind of community ends. It opens up, it's gone. For us, that's what it is to have community, to be awareness of what I call the analytic of action, the fallibility, the reproachability, the plurality of interpretive plurality of all human action. But to say that, again, is to say that I'm dependent on a certain type of community. So if in the case of my breaking with community belongs to the community, then I am dependent on the community in which all share this moment of being evil. That's what it is to have a notion of conscience. Okay, let's have a 5-minute break there. Let you think this over. I can see this is can't be right. I can just think, oh, this has just got to be wrong. So I want you to gather up your thoughts on why it's wrong, and then I'm going to discuss the continual hypothesis is going to be my defense of why this is right. So that's where it comes back.